Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming out so early. And thank you to the CDC and the other conference sponsors for including clinical cases this year. I'm going to present a case from one of our clinics that certainly we learned a lot from and are very happy to be able to share with the rest of the STD world. This patient was a 23-year-old Latino man who presented to the STD clinic in October of 2012 complaining of a urethral discharge and dysuria for 2 days. His last sexual exposure was 4 days previous to coming into clinic. He reported having had 2 male partners in the previous 3 months and practicing anal receptive and insertive sex with very inconsistent condom use. There was no recent travel to Hawaii, Asia, or the West Coast, nor did he have a sexual partner from any of these geographic regions in the previous 3 months. He reported having had a negative HIV test in June of 2012. His physical exam showed only a creamy yellow urethral discharge, and he was treated for presumptive urethral gonorrhea and ceftriaxone with ceftriaxone and azithromycin. On that day, his rapid and pooled HIV tests and pooled net HIV tests were negative. Urethral NAT testing was positive for gonorrhea and negative for chlamydia, and anorectal NAT testing was positive for both GC and chlamydia, though he was asymptomatic at the rectum. His RPR was 1 to 128, and his FTA was reactive. 5 days later, he was called back into the clinic by a public health advisor because of the reactive RPR, and was asked to return to clinic for treatment of syphilis. He came in on the following day and reported that the discharge had cleared up. He denied a history of syphilis and denied having had any penile or perianal sores. He had not had a sexual encounter since his last visit 5 days earlier. On physical exam, he had a small hemorrhoid that was not ulcerated or bleeding. There was no rash. The neurologic exam was normal. The results of anorectal testing from his first visit were not yet available to the treating physician. He was diagnosed with latent syphilis of unknown duration and was referred to a community health center for evaluation of the hemorrhoid. He was treated with the first of 3 planned bicillin injections. He came back to clinic 9 days later for his second bicillin, and at that time the treating provider noted that the anorectal chlamydia and gonorrhea NATs were positive from his initial visit, but felt that he had been adequately treated presumptively on the first visit for the urethral and that the rectum was well covered at that time, so no further treatment was given. He was encouraged to repeat his HIV testing that day, but declined. Approximately 3 weeks later, he was admitted to a local hospital after presenting to the emergency room with severe lower abdominal pain. He was seen by a surgery, and the surgical diagnosis was possible intussusception, and the patient underwent an MRI and an exploratory laparoscopy. The MRI showed only extensive abdominal adenopathy, and no intussusception or other surgical pathology was found during the laparoscopy. On the second hospital day, he complained of generalized malaise and developed a high fever. He was seen by the infectious disease service, and their working diagnosis was acute HIV infection. At that time, he had an RPR of 1 to 16 and an HIV viral load in the millions. The treating physician in the hospital called the Bureau of STD Control because she wanted to follow up on his RPR of 1 to 16, and because he gave a history of having been partially treated, she wanted to know where he was with his syphilis treatment. And the rest of the story came about in terms of discussing what was the next thing that he needed in terms of syphilis treatment. So when I usually respond to those cases as the medical director of the Bureau, I went through both his surveillance record and his electronic medical record and found the LGV and shared that information with the treating physician, thinking that possibly an undertreated anorectal chlamydia might have been LGV and that might partially explain some of his abdominal pain and the extensive adenopathy. As luck would have it, we still had the specimen available from his first visit, and it was sent on to the New York State Lab for serovar testing, and turned out to be the L2 serovar. The patient was treated in the hospital with bicillin and with doxycycline and was discharged for follow-up in the outpatient HIV clinic at the hospital where he'd been admitted. So what were our lessons learned as a clinical STD program? This made us really rethink our policy, and we made the decision to start treating all anorectal chlamydia as if it was LGV. At the same time, several years back when LGV first began to reappear in this country, as a bureau we were fortunate in being able to do serovar testing. We had to discontinue that for several reasons a few years ago, but what we do instead is we save a bunch of samples and we send them anonymized once a year to the state lab that does serovar testing. And what we were able to find out shortly after this case is that we have an estimated 15% of the anorectal chlamydia in New York City in men who have sex with men is LGV. So in terms of changing our policy and treatment, that's what we did. For treatment, we began to treat all anorectal chlamydia as LGV. In terms of policy changes, we've done much more training throughout the city, and we have a health alert that will go out fairly soon to the doctors around New York City alerting them about LGV. And in terms of research, I think there are really two questions. One that we need to look at as an STI community. One is developing a commercially available assay for the L serovars of chlamydia and figuring out which group of patients we need to do it as routine testing in. And the other is, I think we need to look at the efficacy of alternative treatments to 3 weeks of doxycycline, which is both expensive at this point and very difficult in terms of patient adherence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Very interesting case. I think perhaps the first thing we could do is maybe ask some questions about the case itself, some clarifications. For example, I've had a question about the whether the chlamydia was repeated when he was admitted to the hospital. And was he still chlamydia positive, and or was that not done?
That it may have been done. I don't know the results of it.
Okay. Any other questions from the bench?
No, it's just that in a lot of centers around the wealthier world, an anal CT positive test would lead to a reflex testing for maybe LGV. Is it possible you don't have the budget to do that?
Yes. We would love to be able to do that. I mean, that's what, you know, I think what this case tells us is that we need to be able to do that on a routine basis, and we just aren't right now.
Just that our experience from Sydney is that, at least in the clinics, virtually all the LGV is symptomatic, so people can be forgiven for not rushing straight to doxycycline, and the symptoms develop fairly acutely, but afterwards. And what we found in the community cohort is that there was plenty of anal chlamydia, but if they were asymptomatic, it was never LGV. So what we do now in clinics is if we see a gay man with clinical proctitis, we automatically now start with doxycycline and don't wait for the test result, because LGV can progress. They get really ill really quickly, within days, so we don't wait. And essentially, if the symptoms resolve and the LGV test is negative, we'll stop it after 7 to 10 days, and if it's positive, we'll continue it for 3 weeks.
We do the same. Our policy in the unit I work in has been that any MSM who looks as if you might have chlamydia anywhere, so if you possess with non-gonococcal urethritis, assuming he would potentially be infected also in the rectum. We use doxycycline, we don't use azithromycin. We just start with a 1 week course. It gives us a chance to get the result back and to be able to continue with the 3 week course if necessary. But I think there is evidence of asymptomatic LGV. Certainly the Amsterdam group have shown a reasonably large percentage that have no symptoms but are LGV positive. And we've found some cases also in the UK, some of the units there. So I think it's a little bit, I mean, that is a good practice to say if someone has symptoms, you must test them for LGV. But I think by just adopting that practice, we could be missing some asymptomatic LGV. As you say, you could then go on to become quite ill.
So you are able to reflex test those that are CT positive in the rectum for LGV?
Yeah.
That's wonderful that you have funding to do that. Good morning, Anne. Thank you for the case. It's really interesting, and I'm sure this is just par for the course and for you at New York City.
And just another day.
Yeah, and so I'm in the STD clinic in San Francisco, and I feel like we have a lot in common because we have a similar situation in that when a gentleman comes in symptomatic urethritis with a picture as you described, I think we would have treated really similarly. So we are not routinely, he didn't have any anal rectal symptoms at the time, but I think we would have done a really similar initial treatment. And truthfully, you know, we've had outbreaks of symptomatic LGV-related proctitis in San Francisco, but we have the same issue with funding where we're not automatically testing anyone with positive chlamydia for LGV, especially in the absence of symptoms. We did some looks retrospectively similar to you, you know, on a periodic basis with a sort of home-brewed PCR that we have in our laboratory, and saw a much lower background rate. And so obviously this brings up other questions about anal rectal chlamydia and clearance with azithromycin versus doxycycline, but we are not routinely treating all anal rectal chlamydia infections as LGV because we have a low sort of background rate. But again, it would be obviously more ideal to be able to reflex test everyone who was anal rectal chlamydia positive for LGV, but we have the same situation as you where we're not able to do that, except retrospectively.
So we presented this case at a clinical teaching conference in our bureau, and one of the discussants at that case was a colorectal surgeon who has a large MSM patient population. And his feeling about the case was that a hemorrhoid in a 23-year-old should have been considered symptomatic, and that it's usually inflammation in the anal rectum from something that would cause someone that young to have a hemorrhoid. So I thought I would pass that on because it changed. That also has changed a lot how we look at this, at these patients.
Can I ask you a question about his sexual history? Because you mentioned that you guys routinely do, it looks like, both rapid HIV antibody tests on the day that they come, and then you do RNA pooling, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then did he report sexual contact in between the time that he was first seen? Because it was 4 weeks later, and I don't know if he had sexual contact in between then and his admission to the hospital.
We know that between his first and second visit, according to him, he was not sexually active, but he missed the appointment for the third bicillin, and we don't really know what happened in that interval. Though I think that he would have been, it could possibly have been in the window period still, and might have been infected at the time we saw him. Mm-hmm. That's also one of the things we've tried to adapt our practice to is how to counsel patients about when they, given their sexual history, particularly when high-risk patients should come back and retest.
In the UK, someone like this, we would be testing them for hepatitis C because in the outbreaks that we've got, it's syphilis, it's LGV, and it's acute hepatitis C. Are you seeing that pattern in New York?
We are not doing routine hepatitis C testing in our clinic, so I don't have the answer to that.
Go ahead, Brad.
I have a Brad Stoner from St. Louis. I have a comment and a question. I know it's very difficult for us in the U.S. to get routine LGV typing,
yes.
And there are only a few research centers that have that available to them regularly, so this is a very important question. If you find anorectal chlamydia, what do you do, and is it symptomatic or not, I guess is the determinant.
Yeah.
But our question is, or my question is around his syphilis serology. He's got a 1 to 128 RPR, so he likely has early syphilis. And could that, we heard at the series yesterday about anorectal symptoms being consistent with primary or secondary syphilis. Could that hemorrhoid have been simply a nodule that could have been syphilis and not chlamydia? Mm-hmm. I just wonder what the panel thinks about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen, you know, they call syphilis the great imitator for a reason. I mean, just recently I saw a case not dissimilar in a young man in his 20s with, you know, a history of HIV and high-grade AIN, and he had an anal nodule, external anal nodule, which I thought was probably anal cancer, and did a lot of biopsies, but then took a sexual history and realized, wait a second, this person probably doesn't have anal cancer. He ended up having syphilis. So perhaps this hemorrhoid, I don't know if it was indurated or I don't know if you remember the characteristics, but you may not have seen the patient yourself.
I didn't see the patient myself, yeah. And I asked the same question, but I do know that the person who saw him is one of our more experienced clinicians,
yeah.
So I don't know if that... And it made me feel more confident. I don't know if it was...
Yeah, but I mean...
It certainly could have been.
Yeah, but I've certainly seen that anorectal symptoms in a young person that don't look like characteristically like primary syphilis, but certainly ended up being primary syphilis in the end.
In which case, he only needed a single dose of benzathine. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, any other questions from the audience? Yes, Sue.
I don't remember if you mentioned it. What was the status of that hemorrhoid upon admission?
I don't know the answer to that.
It was primary.
Yeah, it should have resolved.
A few weeks later,
yeah.
It might have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Yes.
Stephanie Taylor, New Orleans. So in a perfect world, if we could all serotype and it would come back an LGB type, what would the recommendation be? Treat or not treat if they were not symptomatic? What do you think?
LGB is almost never a latent infection. If it isn't causing disease today, it's very likely to cause severe disease tomorrow. It's much different to the normal chlamydia that we see, which is just a superficial mucosal infection, that where the disease, if there is any, is due to the host response. LGB is an invasive, invades tissues, causes abscesses. You wouldn't hesitate to treat it. In the absence of having reflex testing for LGB types, I think all proctitis in gay men, all anal symptoms should be routinely treated with doxycycline and ask questions later, store some DNA and send it off to the lab at the end of the year. But I think there's, in general now, even though we're getting more and more uncomfortable with our cure rate with azithromycin,
mm-hmm.
So we've pretty well switched entirely across to doxycycline for symptomatic and asymptomatic chlamydial infections. Yeah.
What about duration? What about duration?
Well, again, because we've got the...
We've got reflex
testing, we'll chop off after usually 10 days. If it's LGB, we cut for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
If you stop the antibiotics too soon, you do get clinical relapse.
Mm-hmm.
I think every experienced clinician has seen that, which is unusual with STIs.
Mm-hmm.
Usually our cure rate for everything is pretty... It's very high as long as people take the pill. But in the case of LGV, it's a real relapsing condition. Make sure you would always err on the side of over-treatment, which I something I'm always averse to. I'm critical of people who over-treat syphilis, for example. But I think too many of us have seen clinical relapse and the relapses are just as nasty as the initial episode.
One of our questions is from New York, is there any experience, does anyone have experience with using azithromycin 1 gram weekly for 3 weeks and treating LGV?
That is an alternative regime in our treatment guidelines, but I have no experience of using it. We've always used doxycycline.
And same with us, anyone. I mean, we're doing sort of syndromic management of proctitis because of the lack of LGV serotyping, so we're also, though, using doxycycline for 3 weeks.
My question is, when we talk about LGV, it's always in terms of anorectal disease.
Mm-hmm.
Do you folks who test for LGV find LGV infection otherwise? I mean, we don't see penile lesions. We don't see, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you folks mm-hmm. see them where you do the test, where you test.
Shall I answer? We just send the rectal samples because it does have an additional cost for us. So we don't routinely test urine. But I think, again, there are some data from the Amsterdam Clinic, and they have found inguinal LGV in some of their gay men.
What's really interesting, though, you know, and very rare for an STI is, you know, why aren't there more? Because we do reflex testing if we're suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a very high-risk gay man and they've got a urethral chlamydial infection, we'll actually ask for LGV testing.
Mm-hmm.
We never get a positive.
Oh,
the ratio of genital to anal disease, symptomatic disease, seems to be 1 to 50.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It does happen, but gee, it's rare.
Yeah.
It's quite odd. And there's a few case reports coming out now, but it's a decade into the re-emergence of LGV.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of brings up a question about the epidemiology of LGV, you know, initially described in Western Europe. And in the beginning, at least, we didn't really seem to see very much of it in the U.S.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly about what the current epi data shows, whether that's still the case. Do you know?
I don't. Sorry. Not off the top of my head.
Yeah, in Sydney, we sort of keep threatening to have outbreaks, and we'll get a half a dozen cases in a week or two,
right.
And then it dies out again.
Right.
It won't be a case for 3 months.
And that's that's what happened with us in San Francisco as well, where we had an outbreak, and we got all excited, and then it sort of disappeared.
Yeah. Which we have seen just a few individual cases in Denver. So.
Mm-hmm. There's no subclinical pool. The great majority seem to be getting symptoms, so mm-hmm. you don't have this long duration of infection to go on and infect other people. And the guys who get it, they're very, very busy.
They're
the most sexually active men you see.
But it's funny you're not finding it in the urethra of other men.
Yes, it's mystifying.
Mm.
Yeah. How is it transmitted?
Yeah. Well,
not ALTA.
Well. You've got to ask, there's all sorts of questions starting to emerge about the pathogenesis and the dynamics of chlamydial infections.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of evidence from animals that the reservoir may be the gut.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's long been known with mice and has now just been reported with koalas.
Yeah.
And there's potential for reinfection or self-reinfection.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're investigating that in women at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not really sure where, because this chlamydia isn't behaving like a classic STI, we're not finding matching pairs of couples. You really wonder if there's something we're not quite grasping yet.
Any other questions, comments from the floor? Yes, of course.
I'm not sure if the discussants are allowed to ask questions as well, but I was just curious from my colleagues here from the UK and from Australia what's done routinely in their clinic around HIV testing, because this just brings up some issues. I mean, you know, RNA pooling, I feel like, is the best test that we possibly can do for early HIV infection, and yet perhaps this was missed. And, you know, there was some debate, because we were part of the STOP study in the US about using a fourth generation
antigen antibody test versus continuing to do RNA pooling, which, you know, as you know, is expensive. And since we, you know, we did find incrementally more sensitivity for early HIV using the pooled test, we're sticking with that. But I'm curious what you guys do in your setting.
We do a point of care test, but, and we do a routine fourth generation test.
Oh, you do a fourth generation.
Yeah, just as you tried to, we would have tried to persuade him to have a repeat test very soon after his initial presentation. Of course, it's one thing trying to persuade someone, and them actually taking up the offer, isn't it?
Yeah.